probationary condition, so he'd have since the university.
Good afternoon. It is February 19th, 2018. This is a joint committee. Let me back up. I am opening up the Joint Committee Ways and Means Public Subcommittee on Public Safety. It is February 19th, 2018. And I'm going to reverse what you have on your agenda because I'm going to open up a work session because things are moving rather rapidly and there is the House is still in session, so I want to make certain that we get the work session completed. So Mr. Bender, we are open work session, and Mr. Bender, would you actually give us the narrative and walk us through it?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and subcommittee members. The work session is the second item that's listed on your printed agenda before you. This is a report from the Public Defense Services Commission on compensation plan changes. The agency is required to report their compensation plan changes to you. They've already made one report earlier during this interim to a report on changes for their unrepresented staff. They also have their appellate division staff is in a bargaining unit, and they have come to an agreement with that bargaining unit and are now reporting on the compensation plan changes associated with that, plus one additional change.
Thank you.
You're on deck.
Thank you. Chair Winters and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. Briefly, for those who do not know me, I was the Executive Director at Metropolitan Public Defenders for over 9 years. MPD is the largest public defender's office in the state. As mentioned, we previously submitted a report on our compensation plan for non-represented staff in December of last year. A brief review, we reported an adjustment to compensation of increases of 1% in June 2018 and a January 2019 shift that increases salary by 6.95% but ends the employer contribution of 6% to PERS, and that's in line with other state agencies. We've now settled with our representative employees who are the attorneys in our appellate division. In addition to the adjustments above, we've mirrored the DOJ settlement. We were waiting for that to end, to complete. And the increases will be between 0.6 and 1.6 for our three classifications of defenders, which keeps us about 9% behind our counterparts in DOJ. These increases can be covered within the agency's existing budget between the legislatively authorized budget and the salary pot authorization, so we are not asking for any additional funds to implement this plan. And if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to.
Questions, yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, I won't take this too far afield, but I sort of have a comment and a question. Mr. Borg, when you came before the Human Services Subcommittee last week to talk about the parent-child representation program, one of the points that you and Ms. Miller made was that having attorneys involved early and having the same attorney representing the parent or the child on a clear, ongoing basis actually expedites reunification and resolves cases faster because it helps facilitate parents getting the help that they need, right?
Right.
I worry a little bit that that 9% pay differential is causing analogous problems in our public defense services, because I wonder, I mean, I recognize that the direct work that your staff do is not as front line, but if you are having to pay less, 9% less to analogous positions from DOJ, I mean, I know there's a lot of really nice, highly motivated people who want to work in public defense, and that's good, but I worry about continuity. I worry about turnover. I worry about caseloads being too high, and I wonder about the cost burdens that that puts on our system through delays in court time and things like that. Am I exaggerating the problem? Do you think this is an inaccurate guess on my part?
No. Chair Winters, Senator Hayward. No, not at all. I mean, this is for my staff or my new office's staff. This is my eighth week on the job. Where I used to be, it was more like 30% behind our counterparts. In my experience in the last decade, it really isn't the recruitment, it's the retention. And the retention is so important,
really
important. For experience and continuity, and really to be efficient within the system and effective, you really need people with experience. And it's the retention that becomes hard, both on just sustaining it, and it starts to wear on you, that differences, that separate but not equal.
And just to add to that, over the past few years, there's been some concerted effort to try to shrink that differential, wide, and those, myself included, and those that have been working on this. So, yes.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So it didn't go unnoticed, and it has been that we've been working on it.
I know, but with Mr. Borg here new and this report coming in, I just think having had that great presentation on BCRP last week, it seemed like an opportune time.
And just to, add, one of the advantages, I know sometimes that members don't like reports, but that's part of the advantages of from time to time requiring reports, so that we actually get the information that we need to make some of the decisions that we need to make. Any additional questions of Mr. Borg? Can I entertain Reverend Barker?
Madam Co-Chair, the legislative legislative fiscal office does recommend that you acknowledge receipt of this report. This is a report that is required under statute, and acknowledging that they have complied and presented the report is what we would recommend.
Yes.
I so move, Madam Chair.
Representative Barker, so moved that we accept Delano Foe's recommendation that we acknowledge receipt of the report. Are there any objections? Yes, Steiner Hayward.
I got it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I am going to close the work session on the Public Defense Service Commission report, and then I'm going to open up an informational meeting on the Commission on Judicial Fitness.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You have
because I know often, and I don't want you to think that members are coming in and out, but there is a session in the House on the floor, so members will be going in and out up in that session. This is a time of the session when we're actually running back and forth between committees, floors, and what have you, but it's no disrespect to you. It's just that you've got members that have to go up to vote.
And Madam Co-Chair, we just had the same presentation very similar in Judiciary a couple hours ago, so we need to get two of us will go back up to the floor.
Okay, so thank you. All right. Mr. Bender.
The Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability is here to report on proposed key performance measure changes. When they were before you in the 2017 session for their budget hearings, you asked them to look into their key performance measures and to propose modifications of those. They are here today. I will note that Judge Egan, who is listed on the agenda, is unable to be here, so making this presentation will be Susan Isaacs, who is the executive director of the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Susan Isaacs, I am the executive director of the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, and this is my staff person who is helping me with the PowerPoint. Her name is Megan Rogers-Zarnecki. I had two individuals coming from the commission, the chair, Judy Parker, who had an emergency yesterday morning, and she indicated she couldn't come, and then Judge Egan, who you recall was on the commission for quite a while. I learned at 9 o'clock last night. So I'm pitch hitting here, and I just wanted you to know that it's no disrespect for the entity, but it's just how life happens. Now, we have, of course, been before you many times with respect to the budget of the commission. And if you have enough time, I'd like to give you just a little overview of how the commission works. We get complaints in, and I do my best to analyze them and gather as much information as possible to be able to adequately assess them when they initially are placed on the agenda. We get quite a few individuals from the criminal justice system, individuals who are in jail or prison or whatever. And then we also have a lot of individuals who are very unhappy in the domestic relations area, custody, and then juvenile dependency cases. So the first thing I do is analyze, try to gather additional information. eCourts is a awesome tool because I can sometimes people send in a complaint, but I it's like they jump right into the middle, and so I get an assessment of you. Who are you? Why are you in prison? Et cetera, et cetera. And then in domestic relations in particular, you know, I can get quite a few documents out of custody studies and judgments and whatnot. So this helps move their complaints along. With the commission having enough information. Commission meets every six times a year, and they review all of the complaints that have come in since the last meeting until the agenda is mailed for the next meeting. So they have the benefit of what I have found, and also we ask individuals to help us help them by providing information. Say, for example, they will say, well, the judge was dismissive and rude and didn't even listen to my evidence and wouldn't let me put on my evidence. So, you know, they will list like six hearings, and I'll say, well, would you please tell us which hearing, and then provide the audio. And, you know, the audio, it's like those old tape recorders we had where it would have a time on it, and tell us when that happened so that we could more easily address your concerns. So we give people that opportunity and interact with them in that way. So the commission meets at its meeting. We just had one, as a matter of fact. They had 20 new matters, 5 reconsiderations. People were unhappy that the commission didn't act. And then we had about 6 reconsiderations, about 5 new pending cases where that had the commission had asked that they get more information and whatnot. So that's sort of the overview of how the process works. And of course the issues of keeping people informed and whatnot, we try to do it as quickly as possible. But there's always, you know, we have to go to, sometimes I will get the audio, we go to the county and order it and whatnot. So we try to be proactive and get what we need. Now, here's our mission statement. The mission is to ensure the quality and effectiveness of the state judicial system. Here's our authority and our jurisdiction, because we don't have jurisdiction over everybody. Like municipal court judges, arbitrators, administrative law judges. So, this is our service commitment. We serve the interests of the public, and every effort is made to do so with geographically and demographically diverse members. We have 3 attorneys, 3 public members, and 3 judges. Thank you. So when you look at these key performance measures, you're going to see addressing the initial investigation, and then if there is an indication of some sort of transgression by the judge in terms of the code of judicial conduct, which they must comply with, then you'll see that sometimes it goes to the Oregon Supreme Court. It's very rare. We hardly ever really have actual prosecutions, which is very good news for our state. But there's the So we, when they initiate a prosecution, sometimes they don't initiate a prosecution. Sometimes they just issue an informal disposition letter letting the judge know that their conduct fell below the standards in terms of the code of judicial conduct. But it's not an, it's not serious enough that a prosecution should occur. All of our recommendations, we cannot discipline any judge. So that is outside of our realm. That is only something that the Oregon Supreme Court can do. So any type of prosecution that we have where we have a hearing and witnesses, then the commission will prepare what is called, you know, findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations. And they will put in there all of the evidence that they relied upon, the code sections that they felt were violated, and then any recommendations. And that, along with the entire hearing record and all of the, you know, evidence that comes in, documentation and whatnot, will go to the Oregon Supreme Court. There'll be briefing, and then the Supreme Court will make us make a decision. So the obviously the commission's desire is to be in sync with the case law of the Oregon Supreme Court, because that's who sets the standards for judicial discipline. And the so that's why this is a key performance measure. It's at the back end, as you can see. And it's rare because we don't have that many prosecutions, but the commission aims to be consistent with the judicial decisions of the Supreme Court. And so we feel that this is a good measure, and we're asking that that be continued. And you've seen that before. Now, this one we feel is redundant, and that's why we're asking that it be removed, because basically it's, again, is a commission consistent with the analytical functioning of the Supreme Court and in sync with the methodology that they've set out and the prior case law and whatnot. Now, this is a method whereby the commission and judges can resolve cases where there's a formal prosecution without going through the hearing process. And this would be where the judge and the commission agree on the factual basis, agree on the sanction, and agree on the rules that have been violated. So that's a three-part agreement. And it goes to the Oregon Supreme Court for approval, because, again, only the Supreme Court can discipline. And so we want to be sure, again, that we're consistent with what the court looks for in terms of these kinds of cases. So that's what this one measures. Now, this one is a measure of basically the effectiveness and efficiency of the commission in terms of moving cases through the system, because obviously people want to know what the outcome is in their case. They want information. This information age is absolutely fascinating, because so many people, they'll call up and they'll say, I'd like a complaint packet from you, which includes a lot of information about the commission, and people use that to file complaints, and then they'll call 2 days later and say, well, I haven't received it yet. And I think we are all very interested in receiving information as quickly as possible. We are revamping our website, and we're going to be including something that I've been asking for a really long time, which is the complaint packet being right on the website, and then they fill it out and they just push the button, and it comes to us. So we have that. But then again, you know, a lot of people don't have access to computers, but nobody's required to use our complaint packet. It just helps explain about what we do. And people don't understand that we do not have any authority or jurisdiction over the outcome. And so that is something that we have to explain to them, and this is really helpful. So anyway, we want to move this thing along as best we can, with everybody having the opportunity to be heard and most effective way possible. So that's our fourth measure. We're not asking that be changed. Now, customer satisfaction, of course, is something that has been in the key performance measures since their inception. We have struggled with this one. The initial analysis was done, as you may recall, those of you who were there at that time, through DAS, and they did a statistical analysis, and I worked with an individual, and basically the upshot was we sent it out to all judges, we sent it out on the bar webpage, we sent it out to complainants. You know, our customers are the public, judges, attorneys, complainants. I mean, that's who is interested in ethical judges. And unfortunately, this analysis did not come up analytically and statistically with any kind of data that would assist the commission in implementing improvements. Then we had a very lean time when the money to use that was not something we wanted to spend. So, but since then, we've been trying really hard, looking at other Oregon entities like the Oregon Ethics Commission and the Oregon Advocacy Commission, and just wherever we could to see what we could do. But part of the difficulty is to determine how to measure that in an effective way. And we're still looking, but we just at this point felt that we didn't have any answers to this, although one of the suggestions was to look outside of Oregon and look at nationally, and that would be something that I'd be happy to do if you feel that that this is critical, but we want to come up with something meaningful. So that was our request on that one. Then we get to the best practices. The commission met and came up with quite a series of best practices, and we'll just run through them, things that are pretty normal, performance expectations, high-level goals, annual performance progress report, key communications, budgets, accounting for resources, and whatnot. So then we have come to a request that, as I said earlier, am I taking too much time? I, if you have questions, you want me to just skip to the end?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that this was what you needed to know. Again, we felt that this number one, I mean, the number two KPM, that number one really records the same information, our consistency with the outcomes of the Supreme Court. And so we just felt that we would be counting the same thing twice. So that's why we're asking that. And then the customer satisfaction, I've already mentioned, we have really had difficulty measuring it in a meaningful way to get data to assist us. But obviously, we'd still work on it if you felt that we should, you know, keep on giving it the old college try. Next. So we're always trying to measure what we're doing, and this is a new proposal. And this is to remember, I just went through very quickly how the process works, and this is to measure again the effectiveness and efficiency of the commission workings. And so everybody, of course, wants to have their complaints resolved as quickly as possible. So we were talking about between the meetings, being sure that everything gets on the next agenda. It would be before the mailing date, but just to keep things moving along. This is what has always been what I've done, but I think it would also be of assistance perhaps in measuring the effectiveness of the commission. And then we have the informal disposition letters. Those are voted on by the commission. They are confidential, and they basically tell the individual, you fell below the standards expected of judges in the following particulars. You violated this code section. You basically by this conduct, and we're going to just send you this letter, and then we're going to close our file. But please do better next time. Sometimes the judges just make an error. They're not paying attention. They didn't consult the code before they did something, or something slipped by them. But it's not something that we feel should go to a formal prosecution. So this would be another measure that we are striving for as a change. Where we're asking you to make a change. So we're trying to get in each part of the process as the measures. So I do believe that is the end of our formal presentation, and I will take any kind of questions.
Just a comment. This is one of the smallest actual agencies. It's also very rarely do they have, and they just recently had a high-profile case. When they do, we often have to come back and redo their budget, just so you know. They just recently finished one, but it's not one that we get this all the time, because we don't. With them, and so I do appreciate the update and upgrade of the KPMs, and although you're struggling with the customer satisfaction, I think we know how important that particular category really truly is, and so I hope you find in talking to Ethics and others some solutions to the performance outcomes. So, are there any other questions at all, Mr. Bender?
No, Madam Co-Chair, we are not asking the subcommittee to vote on this particular presentation. I would be happy with your approval to continue to work with the agency in terms of key performance measures and targets that would then be presented for final approval next session.
I think that's warranted, and I encourage you to continue to work on them, and I'm glad that you brought the information back, because we did have a robust discussion.
Yes, ma'am.
About it, and so I look forward to us hearing again when we get back in session.
Thank you very much.
Okay. If there's no further questions, Mr. Bender, you have no other business, and there's nothing else for the good of the order. I noticed that we finished with the clouds parting away, and you can see some blue skies.
With the update.
We don't have a quorum.
Mr. Bender is telling me that
I
don't
need
to.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it is a work session. This one.
No, I finished the work session.
It's another informational.
The third one.
Okay, got it.
So I'm going to let this one go, and then we've got an informational meeting with Public Service Commission. I got to finish that. The Public Defense Service Commission director update.
Yes.
Mr. Borgi, back up.
Thank you, Chair Winters and members of the committee. Again, my name is Lane Borg, and I am the executive director of the Office of Public Defense Services. I'm thrilled to come to this new position here, as I said, beginning my eighth week, at what I hope will be a transformative time. There simultaneously exist many challenges and many opportunities. We are blessed in this state to have a system of stakeholders that care and want to get it right. While more resources and money are needed, money alone will not address our problems.
I want to go back up. You can.
I am very mindful that all public funds that you authorize deserve thoughtful planning, robust oversight, and transparent accountability. Our first report is about challenges facing public defense and how we hope to address them. It's clear that the current model is a problem for many of our contractors, stakeholders, and indeed anyone trying to understand our system. Most other states that have ever used the case rate system have long ago abandoned it. What we need to do is create a plan for public defense that is effective, that adds value to the public safety system, and that fulfills our constitutional responsibility, but does all of this in a sustainable and accountable manner. We did not get to this position that we are in purely by accident. Choices were made in establishing our public defense system. But over time, some of those choices manifested perverse incentives that favor quantity over quality and expedience before oversight. We are mindful that while our audit from the Secretary of State's office found no material deficiencies, it did note some potential weaknesses that we need to address regarding timely processing of contract work needed for cases. It is critical for our contractors and stakeholders that we efficiently review, document, and pay for work requests. We are seeing an increase in case expense requests, which is good, but we need to make sure that we do not cause delays in court processes while still providing adequate oversight and documentation. If we will be able to make meaningful changes to our basic funding model, we need to make sure that we simultaneously put into place thoughtful data collection processes to report on our progress and inform us about future adjustments. One thing we do know about our public safety system is it does not operate in a vacuum. For our population we serve, we are closely integrated with public health, education, and housing. Public defenders sit at the intersection of these systems and must advocate for their clients in all of these arenas in order to achieve the best outcomes for clients and the community. But it starts with a better contracting model. Paul Levy and Eric Dietrich will present further on this topic. The second report is about our juvenile dependency representation and specifically the parent-child representation project. This project has proven to be a valuable asset to the state, particularly at a time when our foster care system is under scrutiny and we need more than ever to better serve parents and children. The PCRP is that model for better representation. And when funding allows, expansion of this program is the consensus choice.
Mr. Barr, can I ask, was this evolved from Oregon or whether other states that was doing this kind of model and then Oregon adapted to that model?
The closest model, thank you, Chair Winters, the closest model is Washington. This is essentially copied from the Washington state model that has been now studied and has been in place longer. And I'm going to let Amy Miller tell you exactly how many more years it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. But the point is, as we've implemented this program in three counties, that we're not just monitoring it through
and
oversight.
I understand that was just also evaluated, and I don't know if it was by you, but I know that there's an entity that has just completed some evaluation of that project, I understand.
I think that's through the University of Chicago, Chair Winters, yes. And that we are...
Just letting you know, I keep up with them.
Thank you. It's good to know that what we submit is good. Thank you. Amy Miller will be presenting more about this topic. But as I was saying, that if and when the opportunity comes to expand it, that is the consensus choice, not just among the commission, but among Justice Brewer's commission that was looking at it too. So stakeholders outside of the system have recognized that this has been effective and added value to the system. And with that, I will turn it over to Paul Levy.
Good afternoon, Chair Winters and members of the committee. My name is Paul Levy, and I am General Counsel at the Office of Public Defense Services. I work with Amy Miller and Eric Dietrich, Deputy General Counsels, but we work together collaboratively and closely, and I would not miss the opportunity to say that they are both indispensable to the work that we're doing now and our future as well. You all know Amy Miller pretty well, I think, by now. Eric Dietrich is focusing on improving our representation in criminal cases, just as Amy has been in juvenile cases. And his work is essential to the collaboration that we're doing with other stakeholders, and then just the basic quality assurance work that we need to do and need the capacity to do. I'm going to try to drive and talk at the same time. I think it's distracted driving and talking. So I'm going to talk to you in a very frank, direct way, and perhaps a way that we have not presented to you before, about what is not working in public defense and why. Eric will come up when I'm done and tell you about some of the ideas we have for how we can move forward and improve this system that, frankly, is not working. The best way to start talking about this is to look at our statutory mandate. It is an excellent statutory mandate, and it's both a guide to how we should be doing our work and a measure of where we might not be succeeding. And essentially what it commands us to do, requires us to do, is to make sure that every time a person in Oregon comes into court and needs an appointed lawyer, that that person gets a competent lawyer, and that we run this system with fiscal responsibility. In other words, as the United States Supreme Court has said, it's not enough to simply have a warm body who happens to be a lawyer next to you in court. That lawyer needs to have the knowledge, the skill, the time, and the support to do the job well and to provide effective advocacy for clients. And frankly, we cannot say with confidence that this always happens. I'm going to talk to you about the challenges that are listed up here in small print, and I will talk about each one of them that we face in public defense today. But I want to start with actually some positive news, and that is that in some ways Oregon has a model public defense system. In fact, Oregon has been the model for relatively recent reforms in Michigan and Montana, and what these states have drawn from is our commission model, an independent commission in the judicial branch of government, and a public defense system that is state-funded, not funded by a mix of many counties, as some states still do. And that's certainly a model for providing public defense today. And we were there before a lot of others were, and that's something to be proud of. The other things that we have going for us is that we have a lot of talent in this state, people who are capable of doing an excellent job, are doing an excellent job, more or less despite, not because of the work of our commission and our agency. And we have talented people on our commission. We have a refreshed, highly credentialed commission that is committed to change, and we frankly have talent in our agency to see the change happens. That's the good news. The bad news is we're working with a very outdated delivery system for public defense services. A little bit of history here would be helpful. Some of you may know this, but until this is, oh, well, there we are. I'll stay on the slide. Until 1983, public defense was the responsibility of the counties in Oregon, and each county found their own way to do it, and it was a patchwork. But what emerged during the county years, which were many, was essentially two main components. First of all, exclusive reliance on private providers. And as it evolved, those private providers fell into three categories, and these will sound familiar: nonprofit, private, public defender offices, consortia, or organizations of mostly individual lawyers or small firms called consortia, and then private firms or solo practitioners. And the other main component, other than these private providers, was that the compensation was really low. And it did not reflect the actual cost of doing the work. In 1983, the state assumed responsibility for public defense, and it fell to the Judicial Department to manage the program for the most part. There's a history there where responsibility bounced around a little bit within state government, but it really ended up with the Judicial Department. And they continued and developed these two components: exclusive reliance on private providers, and frankly, low compensation in the form of the case rate system or the unit pricing system that we have today, where we will pay X amount of dollars for this type of case. And that is the system that our commission inherited in 2003 and that we have continued virtually unchanged since then. In fact, the only exception is the parent-child representation program, which is a different way of providing the service, and a proven one, as it turns out. The case rate system is a problem. Among the many reasons is it does not and never has reflected the actual cost of providing public defense services. But it also, it's ill-suited for legal work. A case of beer, maybe so. They're all the bottles are the same. A case of Class C felonies, some are very simple, some are very complex. And yet we pay the same, regardless of the complexity or type. And we pay the same regardless of whether the lawyers do a lot of work or a little work. Combined with having too much work to do, the natural response can be to do as little work as possible. The other unfortunate rational response is to take on too much work to do. And that is because the case rates have remained low, flat, with very little increase over the years, as the cost of providing the work has increased. And so if you don't get more per case as your costs go up, and you have costs that, such as rental, personnel, insurance, and the like that go up, then you have to take more cases in order to meet your basic expenses. And that's exactly what has happened, and that is what has given us a system that is overworked and underpaid and is not sustainable. And I don't want to belabor the is not sustainable part, because I think you've heard some of this over the years. You've heard from providers, it's impossible to do the job well. You burn out. It actually provides an ethical conflict for lawyers who have to choose among their clients for which one to serve well. And it's not one that is easily managed by our providers either. There are fluctuations in caseload. And so you may find, as a public defender office, an institutional office with employees and personnel costs, that your caseload goes down for a couple months, you're in the hole for $100,000. It may go back up, but these offices are not able to quickly get rid of staff or have a rent moratorium. It's just not a suitable model for that type of work. It used to be thought that this was better managed by our consortia, these groups of lawyers in private practice, and that if the caseload went down, they could just shed some lawyers, and if they were underpaid, well, they could make up for that with their private pay clients. Well, that never was a good idea. It never made any sense. But what's happened, because there is so much work, is these lawyers have become almost exclusively public defense providers, and they cannot come and go very well. And in fact, when they go, they don't come back. We know this is not working. We do annual surveys. We do intensive peer reviews. Our commission does investigations around the state. And people tell us that the quality of representation is inconsistent. In fact, on our annual survey, typically half of the respondents tell us that they question the very competency of the lawyers doing the work in criminal cases. Some lawyers. They tell us caseloads are too large. They tell us that attorneys don't have enough time with their clients, that they're not prepared, and that there's frequent turnover, which affects the quality of representation, particularly in the higher level, more serious offenses, where they are, frankly, outmatched by district attorney offices. Aside from the low case rate and the very nature of the case rate system, the other big challenge we have is the exclusive reliance on private providers who are independent contractors. There's a rich and developed body of law that forbids a contracting entity like the PDSC from controlling or directing the manner or means by which a contractor provides the work. And that's not a framework well suited to an agency that's responsible for ensuring quality representation and administering a statewide system. This is not a theoretical concern. In the state of Washington, the lawyers who were part of the independent contractors in King County, Seattle, convinced the court there, the courts there, including the Washington Supreme Court in 2011, that in fact and in law, these lawyers were employees of the county and entitled to years of back public retirement benefits and other public other benefits of public employment. And we have been served, our agency as well, with a tort claim notice making this very claim here in Oregon. And while we firmly believe that the facts and the law are different in Oregon, it nonetheless is a significant constraint on how well we're able to manage the public defense system. Exacerbating all of this is the fact that we do not have current, relevant, and enforceable caseload standards. Clearly, monitoring and maintaining a reasonable workload is a key to quality service. That's not just true of public defense. It's true across the professions. And in fact, high caseloads are one of the top concerns with public defense systems around the country. The only caseload standards that we've historically cited to or referred to in Oregon, which we no longer officially hold people to, were created in 1973. I'd like to say there's nothing the matter with 1973. I have fond memories of it. Some of you all
not
may
my best year
as well. But it was a long time ago. But in fact, there was something the matter with these standards from the very beginning. They were not empirically based. There is reliable evidence that they were arrived at over cocktails in a bar. But more significantly, criminal justice, criminal defense has changed enormously since 1973. It is much more complex. It is much more difficult and serious these days. We need standards, relevant standards, not so much to regulate and control the people doing this work, but to regulate and control our agency so that we know what is acceptable constitutional lawyering? What is a constitutional caseload? When are you asking people to do too much work and it's unreasonable to expect it and indeed perhaps unconstitutional? And this as well is not a theoretical concern. Oregon right now is surrounded by lawsuits. Every other Western state around us is being sued for the constructive denial of the right to counsel because, among other reasons, the lawyers are being asked to handle caseloads that are too large. And we need to be able to say we have the right-sized caseloads, and we can't say that right now. I have forgotten to drive. Just let me see where I am. Here's the caseloads. Briefly on risks, it's not just that we, with the caseload studies and our other quality assurance concerns and our desire for a new system, isn't just that we want a system that can be defended against lawsuits. We want a system that provides representation, adequate, competent representation to every person who comes to court and requires an appointed lawyer. As it is now, we may be missing out on better outcomes. We may be responsible in part for the overuse of Department of Corrections resources if we're not providing an effective check. We may be contributing or at least not helping to ameliorate racial and ethnic disparities in the system if we're not providing effective advocacy. We may not be, we know we are not providing as expeditious permanency in dependency cases as we can. We know we can do better because the PCRP shows us that, but that's only in three counties. And we don't have as much confidence as we would like to have that the representation in the trial court will withstand scrutiny on review in post-conviction proceedings. That's a very quick overview of the problems, how we got here, and I've touched a little bit or pre-shadowed some of the areas we want to go to start fixing the system. But Eric will come up and talk more specifically about this.
Mr. Levy, for the moment I appear to be the chair. two things. First of all, I have heard very few presentations as clear and well-organized and useful as that one in terms of providing a history, and thank you very much. And when I need to understand more about something in the judicial system, I'm coming to you, so look out. I was really impressive. The second thing is, I will sort of refer back to the question I asked Mr. Borg earlier. Do you believe that the way the system is structured currently also in that better outcomes includes cases dragging out longer because of the inavailability of counsel or shifting counsel and people having to refamiliarize themselves with cases or?
Chair Steiner Hayward or
Senator, well, they're just fine Senator. In this context. It's just that I'm only explaining about why I called on myself. So,
members of the committee, absolutely. Public defender offices are particularly susceptible to turnover and cases being shifted from lawyer to lawyer. It is frustrating, and more than that, it delays justice, not just for the defendants, the complainants. It clogs up the court system. But when any lawyer has too many cases, there are continuances because you can't schedule trials because you've already got two set that same day. This was one of the big problems with dependency representation in the state of Washington, that their pilot program, which became our PCRP, addressed, which was delay, because lawyers just couldn't schedule the necessary court. It's an inefficient system that we're operating under now.
So the follow-up I would ask you is, do you think there's a way to quantify that, what the costs of the system are?
I don't know the answer to that, Senator Steiner Hayward. In part because my brain doesn't work that way. But I think we could try to figure that out.
I would encourage you to connect with your colleague Ms. Cosine now that she's over at the state court system and ask her to engage in that question, because obviously she's more than familiar with the challenges that the public defense system raises. I would bet that the money that we're wasting by not having adequate, appropriate defense, both in terms of quantity and compensation and quality, is costing the state at least as much money as it would to remedy that lack. I would bet dollars to donuts on that one. I could be wrong, but I bet it's close at the very least. So
I appreciate
Chief
the comment.
Justice Ballmer, Ms. Cosine, I hope you're listening, because I really want you guys to coordinate on this issue, figure it out.
Thank you very much. And if there are no other questions for me, I'm going to have Eric Dietrich come up, and I will.
You're going to drive?
No, I can do that. Or no, you two come up.
Beautiful chair.
You're driving?
I can drive. Is that good?
That's good.
Okay.
Chair Sterna, Hayward, members of the committee, my name is Eric Dietrich. I'm Deputy General Counsel at OPDS. I've worked with some of you on projects, but not all of you, so I just wanted to give a brief introduction. I was a public defense attorney in Portland for about 10 years doing primarily criminal work. In 2015, I took a leave of absence to come down here to this building, and I worked for Representative Barker and Senator Brzezinski as counsel for the House and Senate Judiciary Committee. I then went back to public defense world where I did appeals for those who have been involuntarily civilly committed. So if any of you ever have questions about those areas, that's my background. You've heard from Paul about the challenges and risks we face as an agency. One of those is caseload standards, and I wanted to just talk about that for a second. As Paul said, we don't have caseload standards. And enforceable caseload standards, standards that place limits on the number of cases an attorney can handle, are not just a best practice. They're critical for ensuring adequate representations. These standards are shaped by the amount of time an attorney should be spending on a case based on the complexity of the case. And although we don't yet have caseload standards as an agency, we fully intend to. Caseload standards help clients by ensuring that their attorneys have sufficient time to spend on the case. They help the attorneys manage their workload, and they help our agency ensure quality assurance and make sure we're satisfying the right to counsel. The American Bar Association has developed a methodology for data-informed, jurisdiction-specific caseload standards. And there's a letter from them in your materials. The standards are jurisdiction-specific because they look at the particular state, their criminal offenses, their criminal procedures, their charging practices. The methodology used by the ABA has been peer-reviewed, and the studies themselves are conducted by an accounting firm and certified by an accounting firm that they're in compliance with standard principles of accounting. Many states have developed and worked with the ABA over the last few years, and they're different states. It's Missouri, Louisiana, Rhode Island, Texas, Colorado, New York, most recently Idaho, have all been engaged in the practice of developing caseload standards. It's important to us that these standards that we establish as an agency be, you know, data-informed and jurisdiction-specific, and we intend to keep working with the ABA and others to get a study done. For the same reasons that Paul talked, we also believe we need an outside independent assessment of our system. We're looking at other options, other ways of providing public defense services throughout the state. And Paul gave you the history lesson. We haven't changed in a while, and if we're going to pivot, we want to do it right. And that's the basis for the assessment. The Sixth Amendment Center is the national group for conducting these assessments, assessing systems and improving systems. Its director, David Carroll, previously worked in Oregon in the late 90s when he was a part of a consulting group that was hired by the state to examine our public defense system. He served as the director of research for the National Legal Aid and Defense Association. He's a national expert. He's worked in all 50 states, and he's frequently invited in by differing entities, whether it's chief justices, legislatures, task force, public defense commissions. He visited in October immediately for the 30 hours he was here, identified deficiencies in our system, and he wants to work here. There is a letter from him in your materials as well. They have a track record of working with states to transform public defense systems. Most recently, again, they've worked in Idaho, and some of the reform suggestions his group made have been adopted by Idaho. They're currently have conducted a caseload study in Idaho.
Here for one second. We don't have that letter from Mr. Carroll, as far as I can tell. I mean, it's not in OLIS anyway. And Mr. Bender says it doesn't ring a bell with him. But we could miss it somewhere.
Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, I'm happy to provide that to you after the close of this hearing.
If you could just send it to Mr. Bender, then he'll make sure it gets posted and that we all have access to it. It'd be helpful to read it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure
I'm happy to
lose that. Thank you.
Next.
Oh, gotcha.
And then the other piece was the agency staffing piece. Lane talked about this at the beginning. I won't go into any more detail about it. But for quality assurance and increased workload, these are positions we believe are important going forward.
Oh, all right, my turn. Thank you, Eric. members of the subcommittee. So today you've heard Paul talk about challenges and risks, and you've heard Eric talk about some of our agency's plans to address both. My name is Amy Miller. You heard Paul reference that I work with him in the Office of General Counsel at our agency. I manage the Parent-Child Representation Program, so this is my opportunity to provide a quick update to you. For the past 3 years, I've been providing these updates about the success of the program in Lynn, Yamhill, and Columbia counties. And the program, while modest, effectively addresses the challenges that Paul discussed and has the added benefit of delivering measurable, positive results. The PCRP is a significant change in the way that OPDS contracts for legal services. So it's not the case rate, one beer model that Paul referenced earlier. In this program, attorneys adhere to a workload contract with specific contract obligations that really lay the foundation then for what's expected to do a good job. So, for example, there are requirements around how attorneys are expected to spend their time. So we require that they spend a third of their time with clients, a third of their time in court and meetings, and a third of their time preparing for cases. And then they track their time and activities and report them in to me, and I audit them. The program also imposes a caseload limit that allows attorneys the time to provide quality representation. You heard a little bit about high caseloads already. They prevent attorneys from spending adequate time with clients and attending to work outside of the courtroom. And when caseloads are excessively high, cases are actually delayed due to the unavailability of attorneys. I practiced in Multnomah County for years, and I can tell you that at times we would have a 15 or 20 minute court proceeding followed by a 15 or 20 minute scheduling proceeding. There are so many people involved in these cases. When people are double and triple booked, it really has an enormous delay in the entire system. Attorneys in this program have access to case managers, social service professionals who serve as part of the legal team and work only on the most complex of cases. Case managers are really a valued and strategic resource that aren't available outside of this program. The strength of case managers is that they provide confidential assistance to individual clients to help them overcome the barriers that led to court involvement in the first place. You know, when a case opens, parents are often quite resistant to working with the agency. And really, it's difficult to imagine a parent wanting to work with and trust in the agency that just removed their children. That takes time to build that relationship. So these case managers fulfill this critical role, particularly in the early portion of a case when engagement is really critical. Unlike DHS caseworkers, case managers focus only on the needs of their particular client and are able to maintain a confidential relationship. The program is evidence-based, and I wish Senator Winters was here to hear this portion. It's closely modeled on a similar program in Washington State that started in 2000 as a pilot, similar to this one. It's been independently evaluated 6 times and consistently shown to deliver better outcomes and actually save money to the state. The program has an accountability component, which includes oversight by an attorney manager. So, as you know, I track a number of qualitative and quantitative measures to evaluate the functioning of the program. Every year I write an annual report that includes about 20 different data indicators, and I use the American Bar Association has created the Indicators of Success tool to measure whether or not the changes you're making in parent or child representation are effective. And so they provide this whole set of measures that you're supposed to be looking at, and so I use that as sort of the tool to determine what measures we should be looking at and tracking. So this slide highlights notable observations over 3 years of the program. Since the start of the PCRP, I've tracked the same publicly available DHS data elements, and what we've seen are consistent trends since the program started. I do want to make just a note that these are observations only. I can't say that this data is causation-based, and I'm going to get to in just a moment the opportunity to have a more independent study and look at causation of the in the program. But first, over the next couple of slides, I'd like to discuss some of the positive outcomes that I've observed. So first, reduction in foster care. In this program, the population of children in foster care is declining much more rapidly than the statewide average. Throughout the life of the program, the number of children in care statewide actually increased by about 1.7% a year, while it decreased by about 8.7% per year in the PCRP counties. And in the PCRP counties, children are reunified with families more quickly. The time to reunification in the PCRP counties has consistently decreased by about 2 months per year. Currently in the PCRP counties, the average time to reunification is 7 months. Conversely, this time to reunification statewide hasn't changed. It's 12 months. It's been 12 months. It's still 12 months with just a couple little ups and downs throughout the 3 years. When you are looking at reunification of families, though, I think it's really important to look at the countermeasure, which is safe reunification and reentry rates. All counties in the program maintain safe reunification rates, which is no reentry to care within 24 or within 12 months of reunification. Since the PCRP began, the average reentry rate is 8% compared to the statewide average of 13%. And this slide looks at the percentage of children achieving permanency within 24 months. Before the PCRP began, all of the PCRP counties had rates lower than the statewide average. And this has been really neat to watch these numbers tick up. And this is the same sort of outcomes that were modeled, that were found in the state of Washington. So this isn't rocket science, it's what we anticipated, but it's been really neat to watch it happen. The rate has continued to grow in the PCRP counties by about a relative 10% per year, such that they now exceed the statewide average. The current statewide average is 66%, and in the PCRP, it's 77%. So the PCRP is also cost-effective. Applying the average annual decrease to each county's foster care population during the length of the program, I estimated about 130 fewer children in foster care. I tried to track down a statistic about how much foster care costs. I think this estimate is low and it's old. It points to just basic foster care costs, not all of the additional costs related to children with special needs, not the legal portion. But basic foster care costs alone is roughly $30,000 a year. You can multiply that cost times the median length of stay in care, which is right now 18 months, and realize that that's an expensive intervention. I also want to point out, and I'm often reminded, that foster care is not a benign intervention either, and its costs are not easily quantified. There are a whole host of long-term consequences associated with foster care, including health and mental health problems, criminal justice system involvement, homelessness, early pregnancy, poor educational attainment. Sometimes it's an absolutely needed intervention, and it's important that it's there when it's needed. So I did invite a former client to come and talk to you today. As she reminded me, it's a school holiday, so that makes that impossible. So instead of receive permission from her to share her story, this is Jamie. She's a mother, and her son, along with their attorneys, they're the ones wearing ties, and her case manager, Jillian, on the side there. Jamie's an Iraq war vet, and when she returned from active duty, she struggled with PTSD. Her children were ultimately removed by DHS, and they were placed in stranger foster care. Right away, Jamie's PCRP case manager connected her with services well before DHS would have ever been able to make those referrals. At the same time, her PCRP attorney held DHS accountable for failing to provide adequate visitation. At that point, the kids were seeing their mom about an hour a month. When DHS failed to respond to his request, he motioned the court for an order expanding visits, and he consistently put the issue back before the court. Once visits were expanded, it was a short time before the family was reunified and the case was closed. It was the immediate response of the case manager to get mom engaged and the strong advocacy of the attorney to protect that parent-child relationship that laid the foundation for swift reunification. And the facts of this case are not unique. This is what happens all the time. But what was unique in this case is that it took place in Columbia County, which is a PCRP county. So a case manager working in tandem with Jamie's lawyer ensured that she got services as soon as possible. Jamie's lawyer had a caseload that allowed for him to spend the time working with her to develop a trusting relationship and the time to zealously advocate for her on her behalf. So before I talk about next steps, I'd like to mention briefly the Governor's Task Force on Legal Representation and Childhood Dependency. This three-branch task force was asked to evaluate the dependency system and make recommendations on how to improve the system through legal representation. After nearly a year's worth of work, the task force report issued and recommended expansion statewide of the PCRP because it's both cost-effective and has the ability to deliver improved outcomes. And that task force, as you undoubtedly are aware, also recommended full legal representation for DHS by the Department of Justice and enhanced judicial resources and additional resources for CASA. Last session, the legislature directed full legal representation for DHS. And while there is no dispute that consistent representation of the agency from start to finish is needed, parallel funding for parent and child representation was not provided. I've included in your materials letters of support for PCRP expansion from task force members, and I understand that the chair of the task force, Justice Brewer, hand-delivered letters as well. So the next steps, I think, for the program are to continue to manage, monitor, and improve our program while seeking to expand to new counties. In addition to improving legal representation in expansion counties, This will also help us qualify for a free University of Chicago Urban Institute study regarding the effectiveness of the PCRP. We are a finalist for this free study, and it's extra cool, I think, because Dr. Courtney is the professor at the University of Chicago who would be sort of the chief researcher, and he's the same person that did the studies in the state of Washington, so is very familiar with the methodology. The problem is that those conducting the study are concerned that our current three counties, as they stand, aren't enough to get validated results. So in closing, I want to say thank you for your continued interest in protecting the rights of vulnerable Oregonians and for your ongoing support of public defense. And if you have questions, we're happy to answer them.
Questions for Ms. Miller? I'll say the same thing to you when I heard the same presentation in Human Services Sub last week. I think you're doing a great job with this, and I think the data reinforce it, and it would be really great to get that University of Chicago study in here, because once we can demonstrate the economic benefits and the human benefits of doing this, I think we have a much better chance of funding on a statewide basis. I think this is one of the rare cases, personally, where more lawyers is actually better than fewer lawyers. I can't say that that's true about a lot of situations, but this is one of them. So I really appreciate not only the work you've done in implementing it, but the data that you're able to provide for us, because that helps reinforce that this is a plausible next step for us. So. And I assume you've submitted a number to Mr. Bender et al. About how much this is going to cost us to expand it and which counties you want to expand it into?
I have, Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, I have submitted a letter to Mr. Bender, and I think you've all received a copy from me as well. And it actually, the cool thing about the PCRP is, it can be scalable and easily replicated, and so it doesn't need to be all or nothing, and it doesn't need to be the entire state. It can be a county or two or three. And so what I proposed in the letter that I submitted was looking at, I sort of did an independent assessment looking at sort of need, readiness, and impact across all of the counties. And I picked the top priority counties where the cost was fairly low, understanding, of course, this is a really difficult budget time for everyone. And so that is contained in the letter, and I'm happy to answer specific questions about that and follow up.
And I would also point out for the committee's edification that there's a strong letter of support from DHS in your enrollment for today's hearing about this issue, because they have seen a substantive improvement. So I think that's a good sign. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Borg, Ms. Miller, any of the other folks who've appeared in front of us? Cool. Anything else from you guys,
just
Mr. Borg?
Briefly, thank you, Senator, for this opportunity to present. I think that something you mentioned earlier I just want to pick up on, which is there needs to be more interaction with agencies providing services to this these populations, because it is interactive, it is interrelated. And I certainly found in my experience working at MPD that the more at these public safety tables that we're sitting together, the better results we get, and we need to be looking at outcomes for clients, because it's the right thing for them, and it's so expensive to get it wrong.
Yeah, and I think it's just important for people to be aware that we know the trauma that's incurred on children when they spend time apart from their parents. We don't want them to be in unsafe environments, but even D-grade biological parents are generally better than B-grade foster parents in terms of the long-term well-being of the child. And we can do a lot to support families that are struggling with their biological families that are struggling. So I that long-term health outcomes, the likelihood of graduating high school on time, the likelihood of engaging in the criminal justice system yourself, all of those things skyrocket the longer a child is in foster care. So the more we can do to set people up for success, the better the long-term savings. We can't quantify those long-term savings well, but we can extrapolate a little bit. So, okay, Mr. Bender,
thank
anything
you.
Else before the committee?
No, there's not.
All right, thank you all.
Thank
I think
you.
We are adjourned.